podcast site that goes out to quite a lot of people. So if you ever miss or want to hear what's going on the Tuesday classes, there's the Dharma Punks podcast. So I had a whole talk worked out, all nicely advanced for the... I rarely do that, get myself enough time and lay it out all nicely. And of course, then at around 4, I took a look at somebody, walked past somebody's computer, and they had CNN, and the headlines made it sound like the world was coming to an end, because there's apparently some large downturn in the stock markets. And so I figured, well, why not give a talk about what it feels like and how to work with these experiences when we start getting bad news from the world, when it sounds like or when it seems like everything's turning in the wrong direction, or when it seems like if you follow the news, when it seems like catastrophe is imminent. And of course, if you ever pass by news outlets, it always seems like the end is nigh, that we're living in end times, but sometimes it seems even more dramatic than normal. And there's actually a lot of really wonderful tools that the Buddha offered to work with our relationship with the world and how to sustain a relationship with what's going on without it driving ourselves crazy into distraction. The first thing to start off with is, I suppose, there can be this illusion that the world is heading in the wrong direction, or there's terrible things on the horizon. And of course there is definitely global warming, which is bad, in case you don't know, not good. But in general, the world has never, ever been a place that offers any lasting peace or security or fairness. From the Buddha's time and well beyond the Buddha's time, 2,500 years ago, the world was a place of wars and endless aggression, people being unfairly treated and exploited, extremely rich and extremely poor, gross disparity of wealth. There's never been a time when the world was a wonderful, cozy, safe place where it was particularly fair. In fact, obviously, if you've ever been a fan of nature shows, and you watch the way animals treat other animals, it pretty much gets rid of the idea that equality, freedom, justice, fairness is part of the animal kingdom. It's not. In fact, as Nietzsche and Derrida and all the philosophers of the 20th century have shown, these ideas that are very worthy ideas, but they're ideas that are relatively modern, that are relatively are wonderful goals, but when we bring this sense of should into it, we're creating this illusion that the world has ever been a place that offers lasting, true peace, security, fairness. In fact, the Buddha said when he looked at the world, what he saw were fish flopping around in a puddle of water that was drying up, fighting each other for what little food there was left. This was 2,500 years ago when there was a fuck of a lot fewer people. So there's never really been this imaginary time. The world has always been an extremely complex place. And of course the Buddha, when he talked about the world, went further. He said, the entire way we construct the world, or the word he used, loka, L-O-K-E, L-O-K-A, which is the word for world in Pali, is In Pali, when people heard the word loka, they understood that it meant something that was very subjective. That the world as we construct it or experience it is an extremely, extremely subjective experience. For example, I'm sure you've had days where you wake up and everything looks shitty. You see, like, shit everywhere, dog shit, you know. People look especially mean. All the mind sees is ugliness. And then there are days when we might get some good news or something might happen, and then suddenly the entire way that the world appears to us completely changes. The world seems like, oh, maybe it's not so bad after all. Maybe I will find some, you know, a sense of lasting security, or maybe this job will bring me happiness, or maybe I will be able to find peace where I am after all. And there's this endless bouncing back and forth between the way we experience the world, depending upon, the Buddha said, our perceptions. The world is such a vast amount of sensations. The mind is not set up to actually accurately represent the outside world. The mind simply represents what it thinks we need to know to survive. So we're not experiencing in the mind what's really happening. We're experiencing something that's vastly, vastly filtered and organized to fit our moods, to fit what's going on. How much, if you've ever had that situation where you're, everything seems shitty and then you eat something and then it all the shittiness goes away, it's simply because you had low blood sugar. This is another example of the vast subjectiveness of the mind. Now, on top of that, the way the world is represented, if it's not bad enough that the mind misrepresents, filters, and distorts the world, the way that the world is represented to us is completely skewed. In the news, the world is always represented as something that's about to come to an end or about to come to a flashpoint. Every day there's some dramatic buildup that's completely unresolved because it's replaced the next day by another dramatic, big event. On the other hand, in the movies and TV shows and the things that we like to turn to for representations of the world is presented in this very, where there's a little bit of tension and then the good guy comes and sets everything right and then there's this sense that, ah, order is restored. Both, of course, are just complete silly reductions of an extremely large, unknowably vast experience. Now, is there real suffering in the world? Of course. Is there stuff that we can do to help? Of course. But we must start out, the Buddha said, from the understanding of the nature of the mind. To put it simply, one way of presenting it is the human mind was pretty much, or the human brain, let's put it that way, was pretty much locked into place about 50,000 years ago when the Cro-Magnons and the Homo sapiens stopped fucking each other and the Cro-Magnons died off. Boy, so I'm sure you thought, oh, I'd come here to Dharmapunks to get a lecture on Cro-Magnons. But basically what happened is after that period of time, the brain really stopped changing greatly. After species stopped intermingling genetically, things really start slowing down in terms of development. And the brain is pretty much very, 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 very the same brain as it was 50,000 years ago. Well, a lot has changed in 50,000 years. Back then, the Homo sapiens were not the dominant species. Death was everywhere. There was no reason to ever feel secure. The average lifespan was around 21 years of age. There was danger of death from infection, from other animals, from other clans. There was nobody that you could really trust. It was an extremely dangerous place. And by what I mean, there's nobody you could really trust. When they look at graves of, you know, bodies that are uncovered from tens of thousands of years ago, they often find mass graves back then too. So there's not this, the mind was, or the brain was set up to release lots of excitatory, dramatic neurotransmitters. We're not set up to be peaceful, calm, and feel secure. We're set up to be constantly on our guard, to be vigilant in terms of looking for external threats, to be filled with this sense of external craving, looking for more and more things to make us secure, because the brain is set up for us just to survive in the short term. It's not set up to bring lasting peace. That, in terms of natural selection, doesn't really play a very large role. All of the things that are important for us now, I would say, are the importance in terms of finding peace, finding a sense of calm in life, finding a sense of ability to relax. These are things that have to be cultivated. They're not innate to the mind. The mind is really set up to feel that there's this constant series of threats coming in. And when it looks to the world, it highlights every single perceived possible threat and exaggerates it. Which is why today, when somebody in an office or a friend gives us a slightly askance look, it can be like the same exact feeling that we're being attacked by a wild animal. Because the mind is used to looking and exaggerating threats. So the Buddha offered a lot of tools to work with it. The one teaching is known as the three characteristics, where he said to reflect and always know that it is the nature of all things in the world to be subject to change, not only in and of themselves change, but the way we experience things is always changing. If I was lucky enough to buy myself a car today, the way it appeared to me today, when it's shiny and it's new and it's my car, would be extremely different than the way it would appear to me 2 weeks from now. It might look significantly and still drive very well, but in 2 weeks, the sense of, ah, I've got this car, it's mine, you can't have it, this is what I've accomplished in life, would have gone away. We get bored with things very, very quickly. Anybody have that sense of when you swipe a credit card and you buy a shiny new Mac, and it's my Mac, it's my Apple iPod, my Apple this or that, and God knows I have enough Apple this is and that. But the feeling of, my shiny Mac lasts for about, in my case, about 2 days. And then it's like, oh yeah, I have this computer. So the way we experience the world and the things of the world are constantly changing. And because of that, the Buddha said everything in the world is essentially not satisfactory to bring lasting peace. It has to come from within, because the feeling of insecurity is within. It's not out there where the insecurity is. It's in here. So trying to make what's in here, the insecurity in my mind, feel secure, feel like I'm okay now, feel like I have, that I can relax and feel good, is not going to come from anything I accumulate or fill my life up with. It has to come from working within. And finally, the Buddha said that looking for a sense of who I am out there, anywhere in things that change, is a fruitless endeavor. But I'm not going to talk about that right now. That's a whole nother talk. The way I am going to summarize it, though, is there's a wonderful teaching called the Ratapala teaching. And it summarizes all this in four pithy sayings that monks chant every day. Ratha Pala was like the Buddha. He was a rich kid, powerful kid. The Buddha grew up in a very wealthy family, powerful family. And like the Buddha, Ratha Pala grew alienated from everything, realizing that all the riches and stuff he was surrounded with weren't going to be very useful or helpful to him when he grew old, when he grew sick, when he experienced being separated from the things he loved, etc., when he faced death, all the important milestones in life, all the wealth that he was surrounded with was not going to be that useful. So he asked his parents if he could be allowed to enter the Buddha's fold. And he did this because the Buddha said, he was so young, the Buddha said, I can't take you in unless you have your parents' agreement. And his parents said no. And so Ratha Pala got really upset and basically threw a temper tantrum. And apparently, it says he laid on the floor and he stopped eating, drinking, stopped indulging in the joys of the palace. You know, apparently it was a very nice palace, and by not enjoying the dancing girls or whatever that he was surrounded with and all the fineries, he was really making a show of himself. So his parents begged him. He refused to eat or drink, and they brought in his friends, and he refused. And finally, his parents, out of just being very scared, said, okay, we'll let you join the Buddha's ranks if you promise to visit us. So he agreed. He joins the Buddha's ranks. And when he visits his parents for the first time, they take him to see the great king, because the great king of the land is friends of the family. And I think they're trying to basically get him to drop out of the order. And the king looks at Ratha Pala, who's still very young, and he says to Ratha Pala, why do you practice meditation, the spiritual path? Why do you give up all these riches and not be concerned with a career that much? Why do you do this stuff? You know, you're wealthy, you're young, you're good looking, you've got all this, you probably could be a great business leader or a great, you have unlimited funds at your disposal. And Ratha Pala summarizes it in four statements. The first is that the world is swept away. It does not endure. What this means is that everything in the world is subject to change, including our bodies, ourselves. Everything we experience is subject to going away. You can wake up in Greenpoint tomorrow and maybe your favorite market will go away, or your favorite iced coffee will no longer be offered, or everything we depend on externally for a sense of I'm okay is subject to going away. And the mind is aware of this, even if it's just unconsciously. We're aware of just how conditional our attachment to the world makes our happiness. Everything, especially if you've grown up here in New York, when I go back to different neighborhoods after a few years, they seem completely different. All the demarcations and landmarks are gone. The people keep on changing. I can't tell you how different this neighborhood was when I lived here in the 1980s. You don't even want to know. But it's the world is subject to being swept away. Everything that we attach our happiness, that we flow our happiness towards, is subject to change. The second thing he summarizes is the world offers no shelter. No one is in charge. Which means that there's this illusion that if we just find the perfect place, the perfect house, the perfect apartment, the perfect thing, you know, the perfect job, if I just had this great career, when I get to be a yoga instructor, when I get to be a you know, this or that, that will bring me lasting peace and security. And it's not there. Which is not to say any of these things are not worthy endeavors. They're very worthy endeavors. But when we bring to it this idea that it's going to settle the mind and bring us lasting peace, then we're going to be disappointed. And when we're disappointed, then we're going to think that there's something wrong with this thing that we've been turning towards. And there's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with working for a nonprofit. But if we think that that's going to bring us lasting peace of mind, then when the anxiety and the sense of, you know, where is my lasting happiness, when that arises again, we're going to think, well, I chose the wrong job. And it's not the wrong job. It's just that we were expecting the career or the practice or the apartment or the thing or the piece of clothing to do something that it cannot do for us. The third summary is, the world has nothing that can be owned. We move on, leaving everything behind. This is undoubtedly true. When, as we go through life and we age, the things that we accumulate become less and less important to us. I remember being with my dad towards the end of his life and watching that process of letting go, and all the things that only months earlier were incredibly important to him no longer had any meaning. And as we go through life, there's this sense of things and people slipping away. People move away. They drop in and out of our lives. Everything the Buddha said that is important to us will be separated from. So there's nothing that can be truly owned or held on to. Everything eventually that we're clinging to slips from our grasp. And that's a really important way to reflect, because when we realize this, it doesn't mean we just give up on relationships or people or loving the things in our life. That's not what it means at all. It means that we really, really love it from the sense of knowing that it's not going to last forever. A great story about the monk Ajahn Chah, who used to have this mug that he would carry around with him all the time, and he would constantly teach impermanence, 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 how everything is impermanent, and don't attach to things with that sense that they're going to fix you or they're going to last, because they're not. And one student finally had the temerity and said to Ajahn Chah, well, why do you get that damn mug then? Because you always carry around that mug, and we don't get to have our mug. We have to every day use a different mug, and we're not allowed to get attachments to any mugs. We can't put tape saying this is my mug. But you get the Ajahn Chah mug. What the hell is going on? And Ajahn Chah said, I get this mug because there's a fundamental difference between me and you. What is that difference? I already know that this mug is already broken. What does that mean? It means that he knows that one day he's going to open up that cabinet and it's going to be broken, or it's going to fall and smash. And so he had that ability to interact with his mug without developing that sense of attachment to it that would be completely shaken by the day when he experienced it breaking. But his students would get attached, and when their mug would break, they would suffer stress and loss. That was the difference. He loved his mug, but he knew that it was broken already. So the fourth and the most eerie and, I think, brilliant of all the summaries in this is, the world is insufficient to quench or still our craving. The world cannot still our craving. There's never enough. There's nothing we can build or attain or own or grab or hold on to or get in our lives that will end that feeling of wanting more. The only way we address that feeling of wanting more is by, A, we learn to practice balancing the mind between what we're doing out in the world and paying attention to what's going on inside. The more we are able to relax the breath and the body while we engage with the world, the more we're able to bring peace to the body, to the underlying stress, to the gut feelings, then when we interact with the world, when we're at work, when we're in, you know, relationships, when we're doing things, we're not trying to get from the world, why aren't I happy? Give it to me. When we're practicing what the Buddha called mindfulness, which is being aware of what's going on beneath or behind our relationship with the world, when we can relax this, then when we engage out there, we're not clutching at it. We're doing the best we can. We are being attentive. Now, people hear that and they say, but wait, if I'm focusing on how my body feels, am I really attentive to what I'm doing out there? The answer is yes. And I'll tell you why. Because most of the time, we're, instead of being truly focused on the world, we're listening to our thoughts. We're totally wrapped up in what our mind is thinking about the world, and that is an even lesser form of attention. We actually can bring enough attention to do our jobs, to be responsive in relationships, to have deep communication while we work on relaxing the body, rather than building up all these internal narratives, commenting all the time on everything that's going on. We'll know when something is not right or when something is right. Another way that also helps is the Buddha gave a long list of skillful reflections that help when the world seems to be really unsatisfactory and going in the wrong direction, or when we're really frustrated with our careers or our friendships, and when it just seems that nothing's working out. The Buddha talked about building a reflection on gratitude. Gratitude, reflecting on all the things that people do for us that we don't see. As I was talking about last week, it's very easy to go to a takeout place, order some food, bring it home, and eat it without having any reflection to the process that brought all that food into our life. There's somebody who plucked it out of the ground. There's somebody who packaged it. There's somebody who drove it to New York. There's somebody who unpacked it. There's somebody who then put it into a wok and stirred it up for us and then put it into a container. And most of those people are severely underpaid, are often being exploited. And yet we don't often remember any of that. We just see, well, I had a hard day and then I got some dinner. And there's this sense of it's me against the world, because we don't see all of the people that are involved in us eating, and us surviving. There are so many people who play a role in sustaining our lives. Another practice is appreciating all the skillful things that we've done that bring us a sense of happiness, so that when we do something skillful in work, or when we do something skillful, that we just don't move on to the next task. But we really sit and we get a sense of appreciation, so that we're not just being driven by this compulsion, you know, that's often just a mask for not being worthy or not being good enough. It's really important to appreciate the happiness of other people, so that we don't fall into the sense that we're competing with other people for happiness. As true happiness comes from within, from the way we use the mind, there is an unlimited source of peace and happiness in the world. Nobody else's peace and happiness takes anything away from yours. So the more we can truly appreciate what the Buddha called mudita, other people's happiness. As the Dalai Lama once said, if we can appreciate other people's happiness, then our chance for happiness goes up 8 billion, because that's how many people there are on the planet. Or is it 6 billion? Something like that. Anyway, our chances of happiness go up greatly. It's worthy to reflect on the fact that we're not alone, that there's this other spiritual people out in the world who are doing the same practice or similar practices, so that we don't, again, feel that developing a meditation and a spiritual practice is something that we're doing alone and maybe won't amount to anything. There's a reason why so many people are developing peace within, because it actually is a source of true happiness. There's recollection of the Buddha, which is really, really helpful, because the story of the Buddha is basically viewable in monks today, which is that you can walk away from everything that people tell you brings you lasting peace and happiness. You can walk away from a job, from, you know, a career, from a family, and you can still develop it. It doesn't matter how much money you have. You can still develop true, lasting peace and happiness within. It's not contingent upon how much wealth you have. And I know that sounds easy to say, but I've actually met and walked around with and talked and engaged with for many days Burmese monks who have so little at their disposal. They don't even have some of the basic rights that we think of as just fundamental. And yet these are some of the happiest, most fulfilled people I've ever met in my life, even though they live in a land where they're constantly being arrested and cracked down and deprived of access to other people. It's truly actually pretty amazing when you hang out with them. And finally, a really wonderful practice is, of course, having a time every day where you drop whatever attachments or stories we live in the world, and we just listen to a guided meditation. I say that because most people, when they come up and they say, well, I have a really hard time developing a meditation practice, what do I do? Inevitably, they're trying to, at the beginning, when they're developing their practice, they're trying to do it without listening to a meditation teacher. And actually, in most Eastern countries, Thailand, where the monks that I've studied with, you don't meditate in silence by yourself. You actually go and listen to a guided meditation. And there's just tens of thousands of free guided meditations in any Buddhist, Hindu tradition you want to listen to. Just type in guided meditation, and more than you could possibly imagine will pop up in Google. So by doing that, by getting the practice of letting go and putting the world and the dramas aside for a little while, we actually develop this reminder to ourselves that we don't have to be dragged around by the world. When we're constantly always flooding the mind into what's going on out there, we ride the world like a roller coaster. It takes us up when things seem to go well, and it takes us down when bad news happens. But when we pull back and rebalance the mind and have times of the day when we completely detach, then the world cannot completely throw us around, push us around, and create as much stress as it can if we don't. So anyway, that's some thoughts. I hope that they were worthwhile and develop some stuff to ponder.